Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Good morning, I'm Mike Peskin for Brian Lehrer. 11 years is the longest sentence ever for insider trading, and that ruling came down yesterday for hedge fund billionaire Raj Rajaratnam, convicted in May of securities fraud, conspiracy, and illicit gains of $72 million. Federal prosecutors are considering this a watershed moment in the push towards stiffer penalties for white-collar criminals. It was the first case of its kind to use wiretapping, and legal experts hope that this penalty and those tactics can have a chilling effect on insider trading. White-collar criminals usually get lesser sentences than street criminals, but why, and is that changing now? Joining us to discuss the case is Peter Latman, deal book reporter for The New York Times, who covers white-collar crime and Wall Street. Hello, Peter.
Hi.
So just remind us of the facts of the case and what was the nature of the insider trading that Raj Rajaratnam was involved in.
Sure. So before he was arrested almost exactly 2 years ago to the day, Rajaratnam was among the world's most prominent hedge fund managers. He generated superior returns and managed about $8 billion. And then he was arrested, and the prosecutors charged him with conducting a 6 or 7 year conspiracy where he used tipsters from all around the world, from big public companies, corporate lawyers, other insiders, to get secret corporate information and then trade off of it. And he made, as the prosecutors allege, about $70 million in illegal profits.
He had, as a business model almost, the idea of let's just hire a lot of people and pay them a few $100,000 and get insider information and make millions off it. Am I getting that about right?
It's about right. You sit in the trial for 2 months earlier this year, and it was really his business model. It's very competitive on Wall Street, and if you generate really good returns, you're going to raise a lot of money. And he wanted to get an edge, and the way to get an edge is to get information that other people didn't have. There's laws that don't allow that, and he, as the prosecutor said, was brazen and egregious in the way that he would use executives at public companies and corporate lawyers and such to get all this information.
Prosecutors proved that $72 million or so was ill-gotten gains. Is there any way of knowing if the $8 billion or whatever the figure is that Galleon's worth was all based on that?
Right. No, of course it wasn't. And a big part of the defense was that the vast majority, something like 99%+ of Rajaratnam's trades were legitimate. But, you know, you have to ask yourself if, you know, it's very hard to detect insider trading. And if they conducted this investigation and found, say, $70 million of illegal profits, you could infer that perhaps some number in excess of that was also gotten through, you know, illegal trading. So it's hard to say, but surely, you know, there were a lot of people at Galleon that were, you know, very talented traders, very legitimate. Galleon's the name of his hedge fund. But Rajaratnam was really, you know, the bad apple at the core of the place.
Right. So it is kind of odd to think that if it is the case, I mean, his lawyers would argue that this is a very small percentage overall, but it's odd to think in percentage terms, why take that risk when you already have all these billions in the bank? I mean, he didn't personally, but he had much more money than he could ever use in a lifetime. Did any explanation for that come out?
Right. I mean, that's the most fascinating thing about white-collar crime generally, right, is these defendants typically come from, you know, very, you know, solid backgrounds. They're educated at the best schools. They have every, you know, opportunity before them. And the Rajaratnam story before he was arrested is a great one. A Sri Lankan native, was educated in England, came to Wharton, and then really built up a great reputation on Wall Street. So, right, you ask yourself, you know, why would you just you know, sacrifice that entire career that you've built up just for a few, you know, a few extra percentages of return. But like I said, you listen to the trial and you listen to the secret recordings, and it just seemed like this was his business model. It was the way he conducted the hedge fund.
Mike Peskin for Brian Lehrer, speaking with Peter Latman, deal book reporter for The New York Times. He covers white-collar crime in Wall Street. He was just covering this very long trial of Raj Rajaratnam. During the trial, did it seem like this was an overwhelming mountain of evidence, or were there real moments where you said to yourself, or a courtroom observer said, there seems to be ambiguity here, I could see what Rajaratnam's defense strategy is, this could go either way?
Look, he mounted a very powerful defense. He hired a top-flight law firm that threw tons of resources at the case. But I've got to say, sitting there during the trial for about 7 weeks, the evidence really was overwhelming. The government had three or four witnesses that had pleaded guilty that were cooperating with prosecutors, one that worked at Galleon, another top management consultant, another executive at Intel. And these were people who had long-term relationships with Roger Rodham, got on the witness stand and, you know, testified about his, you know, way of doing business. And then they played the audio tapes of the phone recordings, and it was just incredibly brazen the way in which he conducted himself. But look, then the jury deliberated for about 11 or 12 days, and you're sitting there waiting for a verdict, and, you know, then you start to question, well, maybe the jury heard it differently than people in the courtroom did, but it turned out they found him guilty on all 14 counts.
Right. It might have just been a dutiful jury. Juries sometimes reflect there's a somewhat consistent ratio of trial length to jury deliberations if you have a good jury who wants to pick over the evidence.
I think that's right. And ultimately, it did sort of, you know, as a reporter, it's risky to say this, but restore your faith in the criminal justice system. Sitting there as a witness, it did seem like the evidence was overwhelming, and the jury seemed to have agreed.
So he has to give back, you know, $53.8 million. This doesn't really affect his family's lifestyle, though, does it?
Probably not. Look, it's difficult to count anyone's money. And, you know, we look at Forbes magazine and the Forbes 400 for measurements of people's wealth. I don't know how accurate that is, but just 2 years ago, his wealth was valued at $1.5 billion, right? So this, right, this shouldn't change his family's lifestyle. You know, however, it's hard to say. You know, I'm sure he spent tens of millions of dollars on his defense. He's not going to have any source of income, obviously, for the next 11 years. So it's difficult to know. But surely, you know, I don't think we'll be holding any fundraisers for the Roger Rodham family.
Right. He might have to buy a smaller yacht, et cetera. And what's the logic behind 11 years? I know prosecutors were going for 1924, which would have been the record since 11's the record. So why was 11 years the sentence?
Yeah, so it seems like, look, a lot of sentencing depends on the judge that's handing down the sentence. And in this case, the federal judge in Manhattan, Richard Hallwell, listening to him yesterday during the sentencing hearing, he really showed some mercy on Roger Rodham. And, you know, his sentence was long enough to make it the longest insider trading sentence ever handed down. But at the same time, it was far less than what the prosecutors had asked for, which was 19 to 24 years. So I think Hallwell wanted to send a message that, yes, this was the largest insider trading prosecution in history, which, you know, by all accounts it was. But at the same time, he didn't want to, you know, throw the book at Roger Rodham, as it were. He could have sentenced him to 20 years, and that symbolically would have been a much heftier sentence, and I think it was really what the government was looking for. So I think there is some disappointment on the prosecutor's part.
And it's a federal sentence, right? So you have to serve 90% or so? There's no real timeout for good behavior.
That's right. There's no probation in the federal system. You can get, I think, 15% of your sentence knocked off for good behavior. So, right, he'll serve, you know, almost 10 years if everything goes as planned.
If you look at the sentences for other crimes that aren't white-collar crimes, I'm not even speaking about violent crimes, but things that might be covered by RICO statutes or larcenies, you can get a much heftier sentence for stealing much less money. What is the theory of justice with sentencing with white-collar crimes, especially like insider trading?
Right. Well, white-collar sentencing is really all over the map. And, you know, there's a lot of critics of it. They're based on these federal sentencing guidelines, which aren't binding on judges, but, you know, often create skewed results, as you're suggesting. Now, you know, in the white-collar realm, you saw Bernie Madoff get 150 years.
Right.
Or you saw Jeff Skilling, the CEO of Enron, if you remember him, 24 years in prison. And, you know, the theory behind those sentences are, you know, a guy like Bernie Madoff destroyed lives all around the world, right? Jeff Skilling brought down his company and thousands of jobs were lost. You know, Arthur Andersen went out of business. So there's kind of a retribution factor with those sentences that don't really exist with insider trading, because with insider trading, after all, it's really hard to detect a victim. You know, and so, a lot of people think that insider trading is a victimless crime.
But that's, I mean, a little bit of analysis would suggest that that's ridiculous. to get false value, I mean, people who will be holding the stock that's not worth what its value is because someone else bid it up based on insider knowledge. I mean, it might take a lot of work, and we might not be able to point the finger at exact people. And maybe the victimhood is diffuse, but there certainly are victims to insider trading.
Yeah, you sound exactly like Reed Brodsky, the prosecutor yesterday.
People always say that about me. I don't know why. No.
I mean, you should be a prosecutor because those were basically precisely his words, right? He said there are victims of insider trading. Number one, there's the people on the other side of the trade who are defrauded because they don't have the information that the person on the other side of the trade does.
Right.
And then there's also victims in the public companies whose information is stolen. And reputationally, you know, Google and Goldman Sachs don't want their CEO their name bandied about in an insider trading article. And then more broadly, there's a victim of the marketplace, right? So the U.S., you know, financial marketplace, which is the, you know, most liquid and, you know, has the best compliance in the world, suddenly it looks like it's compromised when you have insider trading crimes like this.
Yeah, and some of those things seem not tangible. But, you know, if the for instance, to take one of them, the people on the other side of the trade, if it was just one family, it could never be the case. But if it were just one family and their savings were wiped out, then Roger Rotnam might have gotten a 20-year sentence under the Bernie Madoff logic. But because it's not one family, because there's not a sympathetic victim to go to court, he doesn't get it. So maybe I sound like the prosecutor. It just seems logical to me. I don't know.
No, look, it's a fierce debate, and it happened in court yesterday, right? Is insider trading a victimless crime or not? I mean, there's been, you know, scores of law review articles written on this topic. So it's an interesting debate. I mean, I think you could argue that insider trading doesn't have, you know, the same level of victimhood as, say, a Bernie Madoff case, right? But at the same time, yes, there are people who are damaged by the insider trading crime, and that's the point that the government was trying to make yesterday.
Even though the prosecutor didn't get the sentence it wanted, it is trumpeting the sentence, and it is saying things like this could have a chilling effect. Do you think that's the case, or do you think that if you look at the risk reward and factor in how rare it is to actually bring a prosecution, do you think that this will actually suppress insider trading as it goes on today?
I don't think that the 11 years, the sentence itself is really going to have a chilling effect on insider trading on Wall Street trading floors. I mean, I think what's going to have a chilling effect and what's an important part of the government's case here is the use of wiretaps, right? So this is the first time, as you said in your introduction, that the government has used wiretaps for insider trading cases, an insider trading investigation. And, you know, the notion that you could pick up a phone on a trading floor and call a guy and, you know, have a conversation that might be illegal because you're getting some tip about a public company, you might be reluctant to have that conversation if in the back of your head you think your phone might be wired. Now, you know, cynics are going to say, well, they'll just meet at the bar or the street corner and have a conversation. But, you know, so much of what goes on Wall Street is via phones and instant messages and emails. So, look, I think people are going to be a whole lot more careful now. And I also think that these firms have beefed up their compliance and their, you know, legal staff. So I do think the government's investigation probably does have some deterrent effect.
Have you ever read a study or done any reporting that tried to estimate how much insider trading goes on that isn't caught?
It's a very hard thing to figure out. Frankly, I have not read those studies. You know, people say that in the past, I think generally speaking, even though there's a lot of criticism of Wall Street right now, legal and compliance have become huge parts of, you know, not only investment banks' budgets, but even hedge funds, which have grown up over the past decade, you know, now have huge staffs of regulatory and compliance. So it's a lot harder than it used to be when, you know, things weren't as regulated. And if you talk to people, they might say, oh, you know, back in the 80s and 90s, you saw it a lot more. But now it's cleaned up its act a little bit. But, you know, that's it wouldn't suggest that that's the case with all the articles about insider trading, you know, that goes on these days.
Right. The other thing is that this prosecution wasn't bought brought because of one instance. I mean, he was a serial insider trading. We talked about it being his business model. Were he to have, you know, done it once, it probably would have escaped prosecution. Or were he to have done it on a much smaller scale, and who's to say that it isn't being done on a smaller scale? Anecdotally, talking to people who work on Wall Street, you know, I talk about this case with them, and you get a little, yeah, you know, some version of that goes on all the time. That is a common refrain.
That's great. That's a great point. And it's because, you know, I talked about the wiretaps before. And look, it costs the government tremendous amounts of money, and they have to deploy so many resources to do an investigation that involves wiretapping. I mean, if you think about it, you have to have an FBI agent sitting there 24 hours a day monitoring someone's phone. It just doesn't happen with some computer. It's a huge operation. And most of the insider trading that takes place with much smaller trades on a one-off basis, like you said. And, you know, the government's not investigating those types of trades. So what you normally see is they'll prosecute someone who bought a lot of stock before a merger because, you know, the day before the merger, they'll do a run of everyone who bought the stock, and that way they can kind of whittle down potential wrongdoers. But you're right. A lot of insider trading is just, you know, two people talking, a one-off trade, and that's virtually impossible to detect.
And that's why I question the whole it sends a message thing, and I don't fault the prosecutors for trying to put the best face on what they got, and it was a hard case and a successful prosecution. But what's the message? I mean, it seems like the message it sends is if you already have a $1 billion hedge fund, don't work it, don't hire 13 people or whatever, 15 people who have insider knowledge of other trades. And that's the sort of thing that most people would say, I'm not in that situation and I wouldn't do it anyway.
Right. And the other thing is if you go work for an investment bank or a hedge fund, the thing you learn on day one, you probably have a huge compliance lecture saying, you know, the insider trading lecture saying don't do it. So people know better, but, you know, I think there's human nature involved where the incentives are so great and the money's so huge.
There is one other aspect to this Roger Rotnam story I wanted to get to, and we are speaking with Peter Latman, deal book editor for the New York Times, and it is this. This was a case of a specific wrong on Wall Street, but there's this greater cultural narrative of the rot on, if you want to call it, Wall Street or the financial community. Was there any conflating of the two by anyone officially that this marks that we're not letting, you know, Wall Street get away with things they shouldn't get away with? And, you know, do you think that this was properly put in the context when set against, you know, everything that else that's going on with the occupation or at least the angst around Wall Street?
Right. I mean, that's the ironic thing about this aggressive campaign by the government, right? And they're sort of flummoxed by it because they've taken a lot of heat from certain critics who say, well, look, insider trading is a sideshow, right? We had the global financial crisis where banks, you know, laxed lending practices and, you know, bundling up these subprime mortgages into securities and selling them. That's what brought the, you know, financial markets to its knees. And insider trading, yeah, it's important to root that out, but you guys really took your eyes off the ball. And there's some anger that the bank executives during the financial crisis haven't been brought to justice. You know, the prosecutors bristle at that, and they say, look, if we could bring a case against the bank executives under the laws, we would. So it's a bit of an apples and oranges thing, right? But, you know, the people in Zuccotti Park protesting Wall Street, you know, they don't really care about Roger Rotnam or even Madoff, right? They see, as a professor told me and I put in my story, you know, they see the problems with our economy and financial markets as far more systemic than a few bad apples.
Yeah, it's not the illegal stuff that they're worried about.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Peter Latman, deal book reporter for The New York Times. Thanks very much. That was great.
Thanks for joining. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. I'm the one who says thanks for joining. Coming up, we will talk in a moment in a follow-up Friday segment about how to keep yourself safe or what to do set against the backdrop of these sexual attacks occurring in Brooklyn. Stay with us, please.